John Bauermaster has been kayaking the world's oceans for the past 10 years. In his latest book, Descending the Dragon, he recounts his 800-mile journey down the coast of Vietnam in a kayak. He was a guest on the show earlier this fall, and we are airing it again for you now. I started by asking him when he began sea kayaking and what keeps him doing it.
I'm a writer and a filmmaker, and I've had a pretty good run of using adventure to kind of draw people into stories and then kind of clubbing them over the head with the issues that I'm really interested in these various places we go to.
So but kayaking is a more dramatic thing than putting together a ship like the Cousteau's and having all of that high-tech equipment.
Well, and it's very individual. I mean, when you're in these small boats, you can control your own destiny, for lack of a better example. And also what we've found, because now we've traveled around the world one continent at a time over the last decade, is that when we arrive by small boat, the people we meet greet us as brothers, more or less, because they're people who are spending most of their time in small boats.
And you call this your Oceans 8 project?
Yeah, you know, we needed a moniker for this long-term project. It was funded by an entity within the National Geographic called the Expeditions Council. And each year, over 10 years, we would go to a different continent. We would choose one coastline and then explore it very intensely for a couple months, come back home, magazine story, films, and a few books.
Does sea kayaking require special training or equipment? Is this a different kayak? Because I would assume that you need – the kayaks I have been in have been pretty flimsy, and I'm not sure that they could withstand the waves and the pounding of ocean waters.
Yeah, well, these are sea kayaks. I mean, they go back to the Aleuts from the Aleutian Islands in Alaska, where ironically we started this 10-year-long project. But they're basically – the kayaks we use are not so different from what you've been in, I'm sure, on a weekend out on the Sound or something. We bulk them up a little bit. We take a lot of equipment because we're often out for extended periods. But my argument and why one reason sea kayaking is so popular today is if you can swim, you can kayak.
What drew you to Vietnam? I mean, Vietnam does have real significance for Americans because of its historic importance. But did you want to do a travel book? Did you want to do something that involved oceanic studies?
Well, the conceit of the project was that we were going to travel around the world and look at the coastlines, but as importantly, the lives of people who depend on the sea.
So it's the ecology of the sea and the people and the relationship of the people who are there.
Half of the world's population, so more than 3 billion people, live within 100 miles of a coastline. So what impacts the world's coastline impacts half of the world's people.
Is this a dangerous area? Aren't there pirates who operate on the coast of Vietnam?
There are pirates in the South China Sea, but to be honest, they're not really after us. They're not going to get much. Some freeze-dried food and a couple cameras.
Where does your title, Descending the Dragon, come from?
Well, the shape of the coastline of Vietnam, it was said to be the shape of a dragon's back, and as you were going down it, you were descending the dragon. Of course, the dragon mythologically is extremely important both in China and in Vietnam.
And it remains important in Vietnam despite the fact that it's had communist governments for so many years?
Yeah, you know, the symbolism is still popular. But, you know, the reason for me to go to Vietnam was because I was fortunate enough not to be sent there by Uncle Sam.
Were you draftable at the time?
I was at the very end of that era. I think I was in the year of the very last lottery.
Go ahead.
But, you know, it was we chose Vietnam in part because it was a place that we felt – people, whenever we think of Vietnam still, we think of war. And when we went there, it was 25, 30 years after the end of the last fighting, and I wanted to go and be able to tell a story. We traveled mostly in the North, and I wanted to be able to go and bring back a story about what the people of the North were really like.
And the North is important because most Americans go to the South, which is where we were and where many people still remember a time before the communists took over.
Well, and we have this still ingrained notion that the people of the North are the enemy. And, of course, that's not true.
Does Vietnam attract many tourists nowadays?
Yeah, tourism is booming. I've been there several times since 2000. And when I first went in 2000, I think the figure was 1 million tourists arriving in Vietnam each year. I was there 1 year ago just now, and there are 4 million a year in a very tiny country. It's really good for the coffers of the Vietnamese. It's a good economy, really hard on the environment.
Are they more likely to go to the South because of the American connection? And a lot of returning GIs, hey, this is where I spent 2 years.
I think a lot of those returning GIs probably have already gone. I think that happened as soon after Vietnam kind of opened up to tourism. Interestingly, what I saw last year were lots and lots of middle-class Chinese who can come very easily because it's very close.
Well, you didn't go alone. You had a team. Each one of you in your own kayak?
Yep, five of us, five different kayakers. Again, we tell stories. So I go, I'm the writer, filmmaker, I take a videographer, a photographer, and then dependent upon the country, someone who really knows the place. In this case, I was sure that I needed someone who spoke the language. My Vietnamese is really crummy. And they were going to assign a 24/7 monitor to follow us the entirety of the way. And so I wanted somebody on my team to speak the language so that we could be sure that when we were meeting people, we were getting a real story rather than a filtered story.
So you got a Vietnamese-American.
I got a woman who, well, I advertised on an online refugee resettlement newsletter, and I said we're mounting a National Geographic sea kayaking trip, looking for someone who knew the culture, the environmental issues, and spoke the language. I got 62 responses, half from men, which I threw out, because I didn't want to be an all-male entity arriving in these small rural villages. Sounds like a cliche, but it's true. Many of the places we went had never seen a Westerner, never met a Westerner. So I wanted to present a softer image. So I chose a woman who had grown up in New Orleans. Her family had fled on the last day of fighting. Her father was one of those helicopter pilots ferrying people out to the ships out of Saigon. And she'd been back to Vietnam a few times previously. She spoke Vietnamese very well, and she was perfect for us. That the government allowed us to bring her was a sign that they were giving up a little bit on their monitoring.
And we'll get into that in just a moment. My guest is John Bauermaster. His book with photography by Rob Howard is called Descending the Dragon, My Journey Down the Coast of Vietnam. It's a large format book with a lot of text but lots of pictures, published by National Geographic. And you can see some of those pictures. We've mounted a slideshow of images of Vietnamese fishermen on our show page at WNYC.org. So how much freedom did you have? First of all, you had to go to the government and say, I want to kayak around the coastline. Otherwise, they might very well have suspected that there was some kind of a spy mission.
Well, for understandable reasons, the government in Hanoi is quite concerned about that coastline because it is their border, their frontier, and they've been at war for the last 50, 60 years. So they're very cautious about who they allow. I went to Hanoi a year in advance and asked permission, and the very sweet man running the Foreign Press Center looked up at me through a cloud of smoke in his Hanoi office and said, well, that will be quite impossible.
Smoke because everybody smokes cigarettes.
Smoking cigarettes. And it took him a year to kind of relent. Basically, what he was looking for was a quote-unquote filming permit. I was never quite sure where those monies went, but I paid it because it was the only way they were going to let us in.
A bribe.
Basically.
And the fact that you were an American was not a factor?
I don't think so. And to be honest, I was representing National Geographic, but I don't think they cared whether I would have been from National Geographic or the Hoboken News. They just, you know, it's not a place that knows freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of religion.
So what kinds of conditions did they impose on you with that in mind?
Well, interestingly, they said that they were most concerned that we were going to expose military sensitivities, which made no sense to me. This was in 2000, 2001, and they'd had serious floods there along the coast. Bill Clinton, in his waning days as president, had gone to Vietnam and carried satellite images of the entire coastline so they could try and prevent the flooding. I mean, there was nothing we were going to expose that the world that wanted to know didn't already know. They just, again, they weren't really sure of our skills. They didn't want five Americans drowning off the coast of Vietnam. That's really bad press. And they didn't want us to just choose where we wanted to go. They kind of dictated.
And they gave you monitors as well?
Yeah, they had a very, very fun guy who followed us literally day in, day out. And
not in a kayak.
Well, he would rent any kind of boat he could to follow us. He became part of the adventure. There was no way we were going to do it without him. And I would go to him every day or often and say his name was Lynn. And I would say, Lynn, why do you feel a need to follow us? Why must you be here? And he said, John, I only want to make sure you meet people who tell the truth.
Uh-huh. Did he get along with your Vietnamese-American woman? What was her name, Nham?
Nong. Interestingly,
they have that G in the English spelling, and it's always confusing.
They were the same age. She'd grown up in the Mekong Delta. He'd grown up in Hanoi. They couldn't have been more different. in their families. But interestingly, even though they argued back and forth over the rights and wrongs of the war that was passed, by the end of the trip, he was asking her for recommendations for an American university.
How much time did you spend on the ocean and how much on land?
Well, we were on the sea every day in some way or another. We moved 800 miles from Ha Long Bay, which is those beautiful limestone islands jutting out of the sea, down through the central part of the country where the jungle rights runs right down to the ocean, and then to the big wide sand beaches of Da Nang and further south.
And your monitor said that he only wanted you to find out the truth. So he was suggesting what you could see, who you could talk to, the subjects you might talk about.
Interestingly.
And then was he also concerned about what you might report?
One of the limits they made on us, which was hard for us to accept initially, was that they would censor all the video that we shot. And so they said, if anyone says anything to you on camera, we'll be the arbiter of whether or not you can leave the country with that tape. So that was one element. And the other was they seemed to be most concerned whenever we would arrive in a Catholic community, which we wouldn't know. They would know far in advance. He would know we were coming upon a small town on the coast that was Catholic, and he would alert the local party representatives who would then turn out in force to not so subtly intimidate anyone we talked to from really talking to us.
Because they might complain about religious persecution.
Religious persecution, but to be quite honest, what they mostly complained about to us was they wanted better education for their kids, they wanted better jobs. It was pretty simple. You know, I've been there four or five times. I'm not convinced I've met a communist yet.
But I get the sense that despite the fact that you had the monitor and the censorship and people probably were afraid to speak out, they still did speak out.
They did, especially as we moved further south, where there was more of a culture of speaking more publicly. But on a couple of occasions, people would be quite honest with us about what was going on in the country. And at the end of the filmed interview, they would say, well, you know, if you use that film, you know, we'll go to jail. You'll never know. And so be cautious. And so it just introduced a level of intimidation that we weren't used to as journalists.
So, and you didn't want to hurt those people, so you probably respected their wishes.
Absolutely. You found yourself in questioning, pulling back sometimes.
Do you think that the government monitors believed in what they were doing and controlling what the outside world might learn about Vietnam?
I really don't. I really think it was just a job. The fellow who traveled with us, his previous assignment had been for the Food Channel, where he took a television crew from restaurant to restaurant, which is really the best job he'd ever had.
The Vietnamese people were often complaining, even though right now we're hearing that Vietnam is going through a boom time, but that would probably be more inland.
Well, when you arrive in Hanoi, which I have to say is one of my favorite cities in the world because it still retains so much of its authenticity, you get the sense that this place couldn't be more democratic. And there's incredible energy and people seem to be working. Everyone's on motor scooters and just incredible vitality. But still, there seems to be kind of a ceiling or a cap on how big people can get, especially in terms of small business, before the government comes in, quashes them, taxes them.
You said that Hanoi still is almost like a museum city. It really has not seen the kind of high-rise buildings that we've seen in other Asian cities.
And that's the beauty of it. So far, for whatever reasons, the government and Hanoi have kept out those big, tall glass skyscrapers, which dominate most Asian cities.
What about a military presence? Was that apparent?
Everywhere, yeah. Yep.
You also saw floating villages. How does that work, and what does it look like?
Well, it was the most unique thing we saw. You turn around a corner, especially in Ha Long Bay in the north where there's these big limestone islands, so they have some protection. But we saw these floating villages, houses of plywood and 2x4s built on styrofoam, housing as many as 500 or 600 people in a community replete with schools, discotheques.
Were they affected by climate change?
Well, you know, in our travels around the globe now using these kayaks, we've seen that what links all of the world's coastlines is a trio of environmental issues: overfishing, plastic pollution, and climate change. And here in Vietnam, what we saw and what we're seeing obviously in other parts of the world was climate change leading to more storms, more frequent storms, more violent storms.
We've heard about dead zones as well.
Yeah, well, and I think we were in Cat Ba, which was a booming community in a bay in Ha Long Bay, and I think there were 5,000 people living on boats. And A fellow thought he was going to help me. He lifted up, I paddled up to the end of his houseboat, and he lifted up the bow and, of course, turned the kayak over immediately. I ended up in this very dirty water, and they were panicked because they never go in that water.
Well, I wonder why those people even would live in these floating villages. There's plenty of land, isn't there?
Well, yes and no. Land is very expensive. If you want to buy it here, it's rent-free. If you can build a floating house, you have no rent. And the government encourages it to the degree that they provide the teachers.
It's been 7 years since you took the trip. I suspect if you went back, you would have a different kind of experience. But why is it taking so long for you to publish this book?
Well, I went back. I've been 4 or 5 times. I went back just 1 year ago. I think we were kind of waiting for the marketplace to catch up, to be honest. At this time, there's such a great interest in Vietnam from a tourist perspective that I think we thought that there might be more interest today.
And so the pictures in here would still be pretty accurate if I went to Vietnam this year?
Oh, yeah. It hasn't changed barely at all.
Will you be kayaking somewhere else soon?
Well, ironically, in 2 hours, I'm taking some National Geographic executives kayaking on the Hudson River.
Well, I hope you get permission because there are some things I really would prefer you not see about Manhattan. This book is called Descending the Dragon, My Journey Down the Coast of Vietnam. It is published by National Geographic. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you, Leonard.